Jeffrey J. Kripal. He holds the, Dr. Jeffrey J. Kripal, of course, holds the J. Newton Reza Chair in Philosophy and Religious Thought at Rice University, and he is the author of many, many books that absolutely fascinated Bernhard, Rudolf, who are also with us here, and myself. I've only read Mutants and Mystics, but...
I've read also the authors of The Impossible and Supernatural and...
Yeah, for me it was just Mutants and Mystics that blew my mind, and then, the Supernatural was way over the top for me, but it was so inspiring, it was really amazing. Thanks for that. So,
and the thing is, I got turned on to you, so to say, by Bernhard. We were in the preparation to another show we had, another live show. And the thing is, from the get-go of my show, I had this strange and a bit not very precise idea of somehow there is a connection between UFOs and pop music. And I didn't really understand it myself. I mean, I do some music and I was into the subject of UFOs and related subjects for quite some time. And for me, they were connected. Then I read Mutants and Mystics and now I know. So you really opened my eyes. So thank you very much. It is absolutely fascinating read. It reminded me a lot of Mirage Man by Mark Pilkington, whom I had the pleasure to interview earlier this year in February. By the way, he says hi.
Hi.
through the last interview. And as I said, I mean, as we just talked in the pre-interview, I would love to, at some point, continue this conversation, maybe later this year in a live show, where after I have read The Supernatural, which is your latest book, and which you did, of course, with the unbelievable Whitley Strieber, whose work I've been following since the 90s, since the times with Art Bell and Dreamland. And I mean, he was certainly one of the most fascinating authors in this field, especially because, I mean, he really knows how to use language, and he had those unbelievable experiences. And of course, he's featured quite prominently also in Mutants and Mystics. Well, we are very happy to have you on. Maybe I just leave you to your fanboys here who are waiting to talk to you. So, Bernhard.
When I read Mutants and Mystics, it was like some kind of initiatory experience, I think. Mm. I think it was the most important nonfiction book for me, maybe in the last 10 years or so. I wanted to tell you an experience I had while reading your book, and maybe you have some things to add. There was this passage where you tell the story of Barry Windsor Smith, the comic drawer. He worked on the pages of Conan, and then he had some very mystical experiences, and he had these time loops and so on. And it was gripping to read that. I was very drawn into your lines, and I remembered when I was about, I think, 13 or 14, I've read those very special Conan comics, and they did something with me. I could not say what, but they were very important to me. And there was especially one page that was very, it touched something in me. And as I was reading your book, I was reminded of this one special page, and when I turned the page in your book, and then I saw exactly this page where Conan stabs this elephant god, it was like being in a time loop myself, for a few moments the world disappeared, and I encountered myself being 13 or 14 and something like that.
That's great. Well, that's a lot to respond to. In terms of that Conan page you encountered, you'd be interested to know that Barry asked me to use that page. He wanted that page to appear in the book.
Incredible.
And Yeah, and I don't know why, actually. I just know that was what he wanted. And, gosh, in terms of, you know, your comments about the book did something to you, or it was a kind of initiatory experience, I hear that a lot. In fact, I hear that so much that, you know, my next book, which is called Secret Body, it actually opens with a discussion of exactly that. In other words, of readers writing me and saying, basically, your book did something to me. It wasn't just a reading experience. It was something else. And that, to me, that's the biggest compliment a writer can receive. And really, that was the thesis of Authors of the Impossible. The basic idea of that book is that the paranormal is all about reading and writing, that it had something to do with language and meaning. And so if the paranormal is about writing and reading, then it follows that writing and reading can be paranormal practices, that they can invoke. They can invoke that which they're speaking or writing about. So that's the basic idea of really all of my books, is that there's something about language itself that can transmit forms of mind or forms of consciousness across great distances and across, you know, even time. So I just thank you for saying all that. You know, your reference to fanboys is humorous, but it's also very touching to me. It's very meaningful to me. I live with people who barely know me, and then I talk to complete strangers in Germany, and they can read my heart.
We're in Austria. I don't want to be picky.
You're in Europe.
Yeah. Central Europe. That's fine. Central Europe.
For Austrians, that's a big difference.
Well, yeah.
I'm sorry. I should know those.
No, don't worry. We speak German, something like German. Our language is nicer. Yeah, but anyway.
Yeah. So anyway, I just want to thank you for those comments, because I think you immediately went to the core or the heart of what I'm trying to do in those books.
I also find it extremely interesting, because we are also practicing magicians since, over 10, 20 years and so on. So I'm quite familiar with initiatory processes. So there are a lot of hermetic ways and all those pathworks. And a lot of those systems do have, I think, 7 different stages. And that quite remembered me of your authorization, or the super story, which I think it has 7 steps, isn't it? From the divination to authorization. And for me, I don't know if it was your intention to do that, but for me, I could basically see the initiatory way when you lead one from stage to stage in this super story. And it is basically, a meta ritual for initiation, that is quite similar to all those pathways that can be found in a lot of traditions.
Yeah, I certainly was not necessarily thinking of 7, but I was certainly thinking of a reading experience that progresses and becomes more and more radical as it goes along, for sure.
Yeah, so for me, I mean, as I said, we also write books ourselves, basically on the paranormal, and especially focusing on the border between fact and fiction. And Bernard, for 10 years ago or so, he even developed a magical system that's called mythomagic. So it's playing with the myth as a basic theme, the monomyth, you know, the hero's journey and so on.
Yeah, it's about how stories shape our reality.
And so it was just reading your book was like... epiphany to see, there are other people who think the same way we do. So it was really inspiring and amazing. Thanks for that.
Good. Yeah.
What What I also thought about when reading Mutants and Mystics was all these stages of the superstory could very similarly relate to the development in Hermetic traditions. You really don't talk about it in the book, but I think from divinization, demonization, up to authorization, it's what some most magical traditions I encountered are oriented on. I think from shamanic traditions to Blavatsky up to modern chaos magic or something like that. Did you had it in mind when writing the book, or can you relate to that?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I've read quite a bit of Hermetic literature, and I know the basic structure of Hermetic thought, so that would have clearly informed what I was doing. And I was also coming out of, you know, this immense literature on magic, which is essentially the use of language to affect physical events in the physical world on some level. But mostly I was coming out of my own training, which was in the Religionswissenschaft, the history of religions or the science of religion, and its focus on myth as really key to understanding what religion has been to the human species. And I've always been puzzled as a modern person about how we can no longer believe our religions. And so we have to take more responsibility for what we believe and what the worlds we're creating, because the stories we've inherited from our ancestors may have worked well for them, but they're not working so well anymore. And at least in my own culture, they're doing a lot of damage. Mm-hmm. And so there's a kind of magical work, I think, a kind of Hermetic opus that writers and magicians need to perform to essentially heal the world by telling a better story. I think that's ultimately what we need. We need a set of better stories. We don't just need one story. And so that's really what I'm doing. I'm struggling with all of the dilemmas and anxieties of our modern world around religion and story, and trying to see the paranormal as a kind of a signal or early attempt by some kind of collective mind or species mind to signal a way to tell a better story or a better set of stories.
I absolutely agree.
Isn't that nice? Now, right at the beginning of Mutants and Mystics, I mean, you have this incredible example of Dark Monk, I think is his name, if I hope I pronounce it right.
Yeah, he says Doug Mensch.
Doug Mensch. I call this instant reality writing. I mean, this is going far beyond simple magic. Could you briefly give retell this story as you saw it? Because I think that shows quite graphically what we're talking about here.
Sure. So Doug is a Doug Mensch is his name. He's a very accomplished comic book writer here in the States. He's written just about any superhero comic you could imagine or name. And in the 70s, he was living in Pennsylvania, where I think he still lives, actually. And he was writing a story for Planet of the Apes, which at that point was being turned into a comic book series. And he was imagining this story about an ape named Brutus, who's the villain of the story. And Brutus is wearing a kind of bandana or a hood around his head. And he breaks into the human hero's home, and he grabs the man's wife and puts a gun to her head to force the man to do what he wants. And just as he finished that scene, he heard his wife on the other side of the house kind of call out his name in a strange way. And he thought he better go look. So he walked across the house and walked down into the kitchen or the living room, I forget which. And there was a man in a black hood holding a gun to her head and had broken into the home. And so what he had written or what he had fantasized or imagined played out in real life just a few seconds later. And it was really terrifying to him, actually. He couldn't write for months after that because he was afraid that what he would write would, you know, happen again in the real world. So it was so it really was this kind of intuitive link. Now, what he didn't know, I mean, Doug wonders whether, you know, he had one of his thoughts is yours, that he somehow created the reality. Another thought he has had is that he had somehow telepathically or clairvoyantly intuited what was going on.
Sure,
but he mistook that clairvoyant cognition for, you know, a creative thought or a fantasy, because that's what he is. He's essentially a fantasy writer, and so he just mistook the clairvoyant hit for a story idea. But either way, it's still. It's paranormal either way you go. And so that's how I opened the book, actually, because there you have a comic book writer reporting a very dramatic paranormal cognition that was linked with his writing. That's, I think, the key. It was linked to his creative processes.
Exactly, yeah.
And his life, yeah, Doug's life is filled with other instances like that. I mean, I just told one story, but he told us all kinds of stories when he was with us.
There is another comic book writer that now comes to my mind, Grant Morrison. I'm quite sure you're familiar with him. And he, because just to add to the idea, if it was either precognition or if he created the reality, Grant Morrison, during his famous comic series, The Invisibles, he basically wrote himself into the story of The Invisibles, like one of the main characters he formed after himself. And the comic character was captured and tortured and nearly killed by flesh-eating bacteria in this comic. And suddenly he got ill in the real world, and he was basically dying, and he was delivered to the hospital, and they just found they didn't really find any source for his illness, but he basically was dying, and then he had the idea that he has to write his comic alter ego out to get healthy again, and so then he just took some pages. Wrote his new story of himself, and I think 1 week later he was basically back to normal. So that's not intuition. I think that was actually creating reality. And Grant Morrison loves to play with that thing.
I treat Morrison's The Invisibles in the introduction to The Mutants book, but I also really focus in on his, you know, he wrote this... He rewrote the X-Men in a series called The New X-Men that I really focus on as well. Morrison also wrote an autobiography called Super Gods.
Yeah, love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in which he tells the story. You know, he had a very dramatic metaphysical opening in Kathmandu, Nepal. Yeah, and so I love Morrison's stuff because he's so... he's so explicit about these links between the paranormal and his writing process. I'm a big fan, actually.
And very often, paranormal experiences, however they come to life or however they what and whatever they are. And by the way, I really like the way that you treat this question. Is it real? Is it not? You know, it happens and it has meaning. That's what we want to look at. We don't want to, you know, count the beans. And,
so, and it takes on the form of stories.
Yeah. But very often there is a personal story to all of this, to Whitley Strieber, with Whitley Strieber, it's obvious. But also you had a sleep paralysis, as far as I know, which... Yes, influenced or pushed you to this work. Can you touch on this a little bit?
Yeah, I'll tell you the sleep paralysis story, but let's also return to the, you know, the notion of it's not about counting, it's about meaning, because I think that's the key to the whole thing.
That's right.
So I was not really interested in the paranormal until late in life, really midlife. About 10 years ago was when I got interested in it, and we can talk about that as well. But I think what made me so sympathetic, I got interested in the paranormal because I was writing a book on the human potential movement in California, a place called Esalen. And I got to know a whole bunch of people there who told me these incredible stories that I just found completely outrageous. But I knew happened to them because I trusted them. And I realized that my own discipline, the study of religion, really had no way of thinking about these things, that we had essentially banished them from thought about 100 years ago now. And so I wanted to recover those. But I think what made me sympathetic to the stories was I recognized in a lot of the stories different details or outlines of this sleep paralysis event that I experienced in Calcutta in the fall of 1989. And essentially what happened, the sort of the short story is that I was living in Calcutta doing research on my dissertation on a Hindu saint named Ramakrishna, and I was immersing myself in Shakta Tantric culture there, and which is all about the goddess Kali. And Kali Puja, or the worship of Kali, takes place usually around our own Halloween, late October, early November. And that year, it fell right around there. And I had been very ill, actually, some kind of food poisoning, but I had recovered by then, and I was taking part in the ritual celebrations around Kali. And then I went to bed, and sometime in the morning, I don't know if it was early morning or late morning, I woke up in my bed, but I couldn't move. I was essentially paralyzed. So my brain came online, but my body was still asleep. And this bizarre energy was doing things to me. And my first thought actually was that I was being electrocuted, that there was some kind of malfunction in the wall next to me, and that I was essentially being shocked, because it was very physical. It was literally shocking. And then my next thought was that I was dying, that I was having a heart attack, which a cardiologist told me I may well have been having a minor cardiac seizure. But whatever it was, the energy seemed to be conscious or intentional, and it was like manipulating my body, and it was also extremely erotic. It was, you know, erotic, squared or cubed or whatever pitiful metaphor you want to use. And at some point, the energy was so intense that it just sort of imploded. It just sort of sucked into my heart region. And then I left my body. I experienced myself floating to the ceiling in one of these classic out-of-body experiences. And then, you know, eventually I managed to get back into my body, and I woke up and I could, you know, use my body again. But the experience was, it was terrifying, but it was also extremely pleasurable. And at the end of it, I felt very much like something had been downloaded into me. And now that metaphor didn't exist yet. This is 1989. Nobody was downloading anything. So we wouldn't have talked like that. But there was a kind of transmission or a kind of, in the language of that culture, there was a Shaktipat, a descent of this Shakti or energy into my body. And that was the energy out of which I then mapped out and wrote my first book, which was became Kali's Child, appeared in 1995. So for me, the experience fit very well into the Kali imagery of Calcutta. Kali is this erotic black or blue woman who is standing on the chest or having sex with this prostrate man who's on his back and is described as either a corpse or in meditation. It's the god Shiva. So my experience, which took place all on my back, like a corpse, exactly replicated the religious imagery that I was studying and that was all around me and that was being celebrated at that time. Mm-hmm. But the experience itself was unique and was profoundly inspiring. It really, I was sort of on fire after that. And I wrote that dissertation / book and, you know, just furiously over the next 2.5 years. So I always had linked that event to my creative powers, whatever they are. And it was an out-of-body experience, it was an energetic experience, it was an erotic experience. So when people later told me similar stories, including Whitley, by the way, a lot of Whitley's experiences are very much have those same features. Mm-hmm. I knew instantly that they were telling me the truth because, you know, I had experienced that. I knew those things happen. It's not as if I'm somehow mystically gifted or magically gifted, but I had that one kind of drop your jaw experience to like completely shatter my earlier skepticism about those things.
That's
it's very powerful. Yeah.
And that's what I find so important about your work too. The aspect of sexuality, because in my experience, for me, it's like sexuality, creativity, and spirituality. They come from the same source. They are like the same thing that expresses itself in some different ways. But that's very much my experience as well. And I think of another author and practicing magician, Alan Moore. He also says that magic is art and dealing with language, and he is very keen on erotic depictions and uses this for mind opening or magical experiences.
Yeah, really the first, so I've written six books now, and the first three were all about sexuality and ecstatic religious experience. And the last three have all been about the paranormal. And this seventh book, which comes out in the fall, attempts to link those two things again to show how the erotic and the paranormal are, in fact, are the same thing, just expressing itself on different planes or different aspects of the human being. Yeah. That's been my basic conviction from really day one in terms of my writing career. And it's gotten me into a lot of trouble, by the way. But it's also persuaded a lot of people. Yeah.
You say it got you into trouble. Another one who got into a lot of trouble, and you talk about him in the radiation part of Mutants and Mystics, is Wilhelm Reich. And I thought that was a very fascinating. I mean, Wilhelm Reich is another subject or topic that I treat in my show since the get-go. And he's a very fascinating man who had also, I mean, he had encounters with UFOs and stuff. People don't know about that. And he just shrugged it off and said, oh, yeah, those are those beings in the cosmos and they use this organ energy. So what? He was an interesting man. On the other hand, he was completely objecting mysticism. And that's something I never really understood.
Yeah, Reich. So Reich is very, very important to Esalen. In the book I wrote on that community in Big Sur, it's been a while since I read Reich. I know he had a sexual experience with a young Italian girl. There was essentially a kind of mystical awakening, and that's kind of what got him going with this idea that libido was not a metaphor, but an actual energy. And, in a lot of Freudian circles, the libido essentially works as a metaphor. It's not considered something that's real. And Reich was convinced that it was absolutely real and that it was the secret of life and that you could actually see it. You know, it was a kind of a blue energy. And, you're right. He did write about UFOs. He thought that they were essentially planetary creatures or energy beings. His work on his resistance to mysticism, I think, would have probably primarily been a resistance to religion.
Yeah, I thought so.
Yeah, but Reich was kicked out of Freud's circle, so he was, the psychoanalyst kicked him out, then
Big
he
time.
Went to Germany, and the Nazis kicked him out for wanting to set up sex clinics, and then he came to the U.S.
And they burned his books.
Yeah, and they threw him in prison and burned all of his books and his orgone boxes, and the guy died in prison. So everywhere he went, he upset the apple cart, as we say. I think he's actually key to the story. This notion of a real energy that is at the center of life, but can also be harnessed in various ways, and that is essentially erotic. I mean, this is why he called it the orgone for orgasmic, right?
Yeah. And he cropped up. Basically, no one would know about Reich if not some hippies would dig him up in the 60s. Basically, I mean, and that's where he had his big comeback, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's of course where I quote unquote met him is through those what you call the hippies, because human potential movement was very much born in the 1960s.
Yeah,
and they loved Reich, of course. He was he was a martyr too. He was a martyr for them, killed by the U.S. government, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue about that, but he certainly suffered a lot, and he didn't move an inch on his convictions. I mean, he was a very, very fascinating man. I mean, I think, and this work he did with sexuality and the way he looked at this, as you say, as a real energy. But without, orientation, he didn't have any of that. Even that, he even at some point describes chakras with his, it's also a long time ago I read him, but he just came up with that, I think, on his own, which is even more fascinating.
He talked about body armor, is what you're referring to.
Exactly, body armor, and those, they are exactly at the same spots as the chakras are.
Of course, he wasn't killed by the U.S. government. He died in prison from probably a heart attack. But, I mean, he's seen as a martyr, though, in a lot of the individuals and communities of the 60s that really adored him, I think, so that issue, I mean, if I could just sort of focus on something, the issue of energy is, I think, one of the most important, but also the thing we know the least about. What I find so fascinating about the paranormal is that there are obviously very real, very physical energies involved in a lot of these experiences, and yet it's not clear that those energies have anything to do with electrons and photons and, the kinds of energy the physicists talk about. And so for me, that's a big question. And I struggle with how to talk about that. You know, I'm not a scientist. I don't want to be a scientist. But I do think that what we're talking about has some grounding in the physical world. And so we need the sciences to at least talk around it.
Maybe what physicists call energy is maybe in another context better described as information.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, some physicists would say that. I mean, that's certainly one interpretation of physics. But I mean, when I was overwhelmed in Calcutta by whatever that was that overwhelmed me, there was information in it of a sort, because it helped produce that first book. But, it was doing things to me. I mean, I thought it was bad wiring in the wall. So, I mean, it was both. It was both. And that's what's so puzzling about this stuff.
I'm reminded, Rudolf, you told me about one of your very first kickoff experiences into the work with magic. You had an out-of-body experience as well, and it was connected somehow to an succubus or something.
I'm not exactly sure, but when I heard your description of your out-of-body experience, I basically had the same experience living in Vienna, and I was a very rational-minded person, and I was a stock trader and stuff like that, so very, very down-to-earth and mathematics and stuff like that and politics. And for me, everything that was that came close to esoteric topics was just bullshit for me. Let's call it that. And one night I woke up, had a sleep paralysis, and there was a female entity hovering above my bed, and we were communicating. It was like, for whatever reason, I was totally calm. I knew her from, I have no idea from where, and we communicated, and then I had a blackout about what we had communicated, and then she told me, okay, I told you now, and are you ready for the experience? And if you are ready for the experience, just nod three times with your head. And I was yelling and screaming, and I was like, I have no fucking idea what we just talked about, but my body automatically just, I watched my head nodding three times, and I was yelling at myself, stop this, and you're crazy. And yeah, suddenly I was out of my body, hovering in my room, and everything was black and white, and it was absolutely terrifying. So there was no actual sexual energy involved during this experience. It was just pure horror trip. But basically, I was fighting for 2 or 3 hours to just get back into my body, and I was pulled out again, and I just thought I'm either going to die or going crazy. And then I wasn't sure what was better for myself at the moment. And
now you're just dead crazy.
Yeah, exactly.
You're sitting here with us.
But that was my, let's call it awakening moment. That was quite similar to yours. And from that on, I encountered quite a lot of experiences where this energy came through extremely, extremely erotic and sexual in a way. So I'm not sure if it was like a Kundalini experience, I think would be the best metaphor or the best framework I could come up with. So it's one of the basic things I work in magic, is this kind of energy that is in a way sexual, but that can be transformed in all different kind of directions into creativity and whatever. So
I think the question I get asked a lot is how to relate the terror or the horror and the erotic bliss. And it seems to me your story fits that pattern well, as it starts out as terror, but it morphs into something that's more integrated and much more pleasurable. And I think that's kind of the pattern that you want. Ultimately not about horror, I don't think. I think horror is a is an early stage of the process.
Exactly. For me, it was just it totally blew my mind, and it just eradicated my worldview I built up for 26 years or so. So
yeah.
So that was the first world you lost.
not the first world, but yeah.
Because I like this notion that you also bring up, Jeff, that you need to at least lose two worlds, i.e. world views, things you firmly believe in and that explain the world for you. Because after you lose the first one, you might tend to another one, and only after the second one also goes bust, you realize, well, maybe I need to move up a level. I don't know. How would you put that?
Right. Well, I work with a lot of students, both undergraduates and PhD students, and most of my PhD students have lost one worldview, and I always tell them that they need to lose a second one now, because for the reasons you just stated, I think a lot of human beings lose one worldview, but then they just take up another, and they pretend or think that that second worldview is going to answer all their questions, and that it's somehow absolute or permanent. But of course, it's not. And when that second world collapses or dissolves, then of course the temptation is to take up a third world. But by that time, you know, most people are beginning to be suspicious of any worldview and are moving into a kind of higher meta level where they see that all cultures and all religions and all worldviews are relative, and that whatever there is that transcends those, it doesn't lie in a particular worldview or religious tradition. It's something else. And I think that's very hard. That's very difficult for people to get to. But of course, I think a lot of people do get to it. And so that's what I meant by that saying.
You also said that experience influences the paranormal, what people experience during a paranormal event, i.e. the pulp fiction and science fiction stories we read in our youth later might come true because something that happens to us takes on the form of what we read. I also think that's a very fascinating concept. So in this sense, it is important to write good science fiction so we make better experiences.
Right. So this in the academy, we call this reflexivity, that you're always being shaped by your past, but you're also shaping your future by your present choices. But the best example I've ever heard of that is actually from Whitley Strieber. We were in a conference together, and this issue of, you know, a lot of debunkers of Whitley look at his experiences and then they look at his earlier fiction and they say, well, of course, you know, he experienced what he wrote about. His experiences are just hallucinations of his science fiction writing.
And maybe on a level they are, you know?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. So the way Whitley responds to that, which is exactly how I would respond to it, is, well, of course he saw and felt and experienced the science fiction, or the, as he put it, the bad science fiction movies of his youth in the 1950s. Of course those shaped his experiences. But that doesn't mean that there's not something there speaking through those images and those narratives. And so his response is, well, we need to write better science fiction. We need to make better science fiction movies so that we can have fuller and more and better paranormal experiences. So there's a kind of loop there. There's an awareness that we're being shaped by our cultural imagination, but there's also an awareness that we can use that cultural imagination to have better experiences and to frankly live in a better story again. It goes back to the issue of storytelling. And of course, the ultimate question is, you know, of course, what we're seeing on the screen of our minds is like a movie, whether it's a dream or a vision or a paranormal experience. And of course, it's all being shaped and written by those who have gone before us, but there's still a light at the back of the room. There's still a projector that is projecting all of these stories, and that's a different question, what that is. And I think that's where you get into the question of consciousness and mind, and you start to move out of the specific stories into that which is projecting all of these stories. And that's kind of where the Mutants and Mystics book ends. It sort of moves in that direction. So I would completely affirm that we're shaped by our stories and by our cultures. No, I would never argue that a particular paranormal literature is the answer, you know, because it's not. It's just another narrative frame of who we are.
So you mentioned the human potential movement, and you also say, it's also, I think, in the beginning of Mutants and Mystics, that what you study is the human beings that come to realize that they are gods, superhumans, or even superheroes. And at the end of the day, that we are responsible for the story we live in. We can't blame it on anyone, basically. Is that like, could that be a bottom line?
Well, yeah, it's certainly a bottom line for me. But the question is who the we is there in that sentence, right? Yeah. Because as individuals, of course, we are not responsible for the stories that we live in. Go back to the movie metaphor. If you sit in a theater and you watch a movie, the movie looks like it's effortless and natural, but in fact, when the movie ends and you see that long list of names of all the people that took to make that movie, you realize that every second of that movie took thousands of hours of human labor. Whether it's driving a car or serving a meal or creating some scene of animation or whatever it is, that hour and a half that looked effortless to you actually took tens of thousands of hours of human labor and probably tens of millions of dollars. And I think the same thing is true when we have a religious vision or we have a paranormal experience. It appears to be effortless, it appears to have a life of its own, but in fact, it requires millions of hours of human life and generations that have gone before us who have been building basilicas and performing rituals and reading texts and on and on and on. So as individuals, we are not responsible for these stories, because we're just individuals, but as a group or as a collective, we are, and what we're doing now will change the visions and afterlife experiences of those who come after us. So we're responsible collectively, but I'm not, of course, blaming you three guys for what's happening to the world. That wouldn't be fair. I would say you're part of the solution, but that solution probably isn't going to appear in our own lives. We're sort of working for the future. That's how I would frame that. Yeah.
Let me ask you one question about the future. I get the notion that worldwide, more and more paranormal experiences are rising, or they come into consciousness. I think the Mysterium Tremens et Fascinans, what one experiences when confronted with the numinous, that's more and more in our consciousness. Do you think this will lead to some new revelation or something like that?
So I'm a historian of religions, and I can guarantee you that there will be future revelations. I mean, if the past is any mark of the present or future, of course there will be. Whatever we want to call it, we call it God or mind or consciousness or the sacred or whatever we want to call it, it's always revealing itself to human individuals and human communities. And I think you are seeing a rise of what we call the paranormal in the modern world, because again, the traditional religious stories are wearing very thin and causing a lot of damage. But that's simply how the history of religions works. The history of religions is one long history of old stories being replaced by new stories, which then become old stories and are replaced again by new stories. That's simply how it works. And I don't see any reason why it won't continue to work like that.
So what shape will our new gods take on? will they be Superman or
well,
please not.
I think this is what I was trying to get at with the superstory language, is that I think you do have an emergent set of mythologies developing, and I think one of the key things about those stories is their deep conversation with the sciences. You know, the sciences is something we didn't have 2,000 years ago. And I do not think science is our answer. I do not think science is the only way to know something about the world. But I do think science is providing us with fundamentally new knowledge that is leading to fundamentally new mythologies and worldviews. So I think and the power of science is that it's not culturally relative. I mean, it's relative in the sense you need resources and institutions to perform it, but it's not relative in the sense that, a chemistry experiment in Austria will work more or less like one in Houston if you take into account the altitude and such things. In other words, it's not culturally relative. Your results are not. So I think that's going to change the map in some way. The danger is that we believe in science in a way that is inappropriate. We become scientistic about it. And that's really what Authors of the Impossible was all about, was trying to get people to see that the scientific method is not the way to go if you want to understand the paranormal, because that's not what it's about. The paranormal is not about guessing cards in a laboratory. It's not about statistics. Yes. It's not about statistical relevance. The paranormal is about meaning and story and changing individual lives, and none of those things are scientific. They're in a completely different order. So I think the new story or set of stories we're going to be telling ourselves in 200 or 300 years will be completely reshaped by the sciences, but they will not be scientific in this sort of materialist or mechanistic sense.
At some other point, you say the best way to keep any to kill any paranormal phenomena is to try to reproduce it in the laboratory.
Right.
And I totally agree.
That's true. I mean, if you wanted to go,
it's a shame, but
scientifically, yeah.
But there you go. I mean, it would be too easy, maybe. I think you have to run soon, because there's the next radio interview waiting for you. So maybe coming to the end of our fascinating chat that we had, thank you again for taking the time. Your upcoming book, The Secret Body, I think, is the title. Could you give us a brief outlook on it? So
yeah,
as I understand
yeah.
it, you want to make sense of it all. Yeah, you want to.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the book is called Secret Body, and the genesis of it is this. So I've written these six books, and they're all on entirely different things. So the first book is on Hindu Tantra, and the second book's on scholars of mysticism, and the third book's on California counterculture, and so on and so on. So whenever I travel and lecture, people always have read one of those books and they think that's who I am. And I get frustrated because that's not who I am. I think all these things. And so what Secret Body is, it's an attempt to pull all of those books together between two covers and say, okay, folks, this is what I think I'm saying. And so it's a kind of meta book. It's a kind of, it's the secret of all the other books condensed into a single book. And it's a memoir. It's a manifesto. I actually appear in it as a superhero at one point, believe it or not. So there's a kind of there's some funny moments in it too.
Are you wearing a cape?
No, I'm not. It's actually it's 3 pages from a graphic novel that were begun on my life, and they illustrate the Calcutta sleep paralysis experience.
Oh wow!
So maybe that's what caused it backwards.
Yeah, no cape.
Okay. No red and blue cape.
Thanks.
No.
Okay. Well, thank you. Are there any final words from your side that you want to give us on our way down into the rabbit hole?
No, I want to come back and talk to the fanboys.
Yeah.
Very much looking forward to it.
Yeah, and I want to know more about what you're all doing in writing. And
okay.
My German is very, very basic. My mother's side, I am German on my mother's side, but they immigrated 150 years ago, so we've long lost German as a spoken language. But I would really like to know what you're doing. I try to keep up with European developments in certainly in French, much less so in German, but I would like to be educated.
And the fanboys love to tell you all about it. Be sure about that. And
good.
Me, of course, who's become, I would also count me as a beginner fanboy. I would, of course, be very happy to, after I've read The Supernatural, to invite you back on my show, that then to do a live show, because that's actually what I really love to do. But I think this chat we just had now was very fascinating, and it's a great appetizer for maybe a longer show. And as I said, I mean, the UFO phenomenon is kind of central to my show, and the way you and Whitley, I think, are taking it. I heard some interviews you did with Whitley on your book, so I have an idea what's in there, and I think that
right.
is really, really fascinating and relevant. I'm pretty
Good.
Sure, even before I've read it. But I'll do that, and then I'll come back to you, Jeff. Thank you very much for your time, and all the best for your future work. And love to talk to you again.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.